Next case is 95-2467, Foster Wheeler Environ Spots versus Rankin County Convention Facilities Authority. Mr. Fry.
Contract specifically called for changes to be in writing. They weren't. The contract wasn't followed. End of case.
We want to make that certainly we believe the contract called for explicit authorization from the owner of the job, the convention authority, before there was any alteration of the scope of the work. And it was in this contract, we believe, in several places. And we believe that the Court of Appeals just simply missed it and got off on a tangent by looking at the footnote on one page of this very lengthy contract.
And let's talk about the footnote for a minute, if the Code of Counsel fit. Your argument that that footnote, when read as an arithmetic, really only has a purpose in arithmetically denoting what will be paid on the excess on the 140. I do not follow that. Where you tell us in the reply brief that if you substitute the number for unit price, that somehow takes the sting away from the argument that your opponent makes.
Let me try to address it this way, Your Honor. There are two places in this contract where either in the same clause or on the same page, unit prices are talked about in one sentence with the word may, and in another sentence with the word either will or shall. One of those is on page S37 of the record, and it says under unit price contract, the owner may by written instructions to the contractor and so forth. Then it goes on to say the costs of such increase or decrease shall be computed at the unit price bid. And then we get back to contract attachment A, which we tried to address in reply brief, where it says the unit prices may be used to adjust the contract sum should there be an authorized increase or decrease. Then you get to the footnote, and the footnote says the unit price will be used to adjust the contract sum up or down.
Yeah. But
my point was, it's an arithmetic explanation that once an authorized adjustment is allowed by the owner, that it will be used, unit price will be used.
How is that anything but redundant? I mean, that's what it says anyway.
Why
would one need such an, if indeed it is merely an explanatory, I'm not sure what it explains that isn't plain from the other paragraphs. You've got the same number, and you have the word unit price, and the only distinction is may and shall, or will, and explicitly referencing the potential for more or less work, more or less cubic yards than 140. You know, it really refers to that exact thing that we end up having a problem with.
All I can say, Your Honor, is that the contract is...
Isn't it redundant?
And it is potentially redundant.
Your explanation that it's just arithmetic, I think, is a little bit tough because it is simply redundant to say that it had no meaning other than to put the number in when the number's right there.
Well, but I think that, just as I say, that there's another place where unit prices are explained in another page of the contract.
Okay.
Then they put the contract attachment A in to say it all again. There is a great deal of redundancy in these contract documents.
Okay.
And my only way to understand why you would have to put them is to explain the text, because it's obviously a subsidiary subordinate kind of position. And the only way it makes sense to me is that they would just make it what was otherwise obvious explicit, that you have to use $265 per yard if within the authorized increase or decrease.
And the only other explanation, of course, is the one your opponent offers, which is we're going to make it clear that we all understand that this is the scope of the work. We all know it's going to vary, and we're fine with it. And it doesn't need to be authorized.
And that I don't believe follows, Your Honor, when you look at the various provisions on unit price contract, they all are conditional. They all suggest in the preeminent paragraphs, the preeminent sentences, the words may are always used. And it's clear to me, I think, that this is not a great drafting job by whoever drafted it, but they would not have...
That kind of matters, doesn't it?
Well...
Who did draft it?
The owner drafted it.
Right.
I understand. And the problem is that you have to assume almost stupidity by the owner to say that in contract attachment A, they said may at one place and on the same page, they said shall at the bottom. They obviously didn't have in mind building in that kind of ambiguity, particularly within one page addressing the precedent. And so I think we have to look, and the law allows us to look, at all of the issue here to try to rationalize the whole contract, as Justice Douglas said, which is the easiest way to decide the case.
When you look at that contract, to me, it's clear, you know, I've drawn maybe a dozen of these kind of contracts during practice, and you always put this change order in writing provision in there so you don't get to the end and have this kind of problem. Isn't it a little tough in this case? Should there be some quantum merit?
I don't believe it should, Your Honor. This court has historically been loath to give quantum merit recoveries on public contracts because of the risk that public projects will go bankrupt or that the taxpayers will get built. And that's an observation on human nature which goes back more than 100 years from this court about the nature of the contract and so forth. Clearly, in extreme cases like the Lathrop case in 5 Ohio State 2nd, where Toledo wrote that specification, the bridge didn't get painted correctly, they ordered the contractor, go fix it, then you need to vary the rigidity of the law when you didn't have the paperwork in place to do it. But that's a very extreme case, and we should not invite contractors to ignore the contracts and not be doing what people need to have.
Counsel, isn't that what the contractor here says your client asked them to do? I mean, this case goes out on summary.
Right.
You represent law.
No, I've got the owner.
You've got the owner.
Yes.
Well, who represents law?
Suppliers and the captain.
Okay.
But that's their way of getting around the written contract. Just to say, well, this on-site monitor from law on was out there. He didn't stop us for it. But that's a very bad way from a public perspective or any owner's perspective, even a private job, to run a job and say, well, we kept working because you guys didn't stop us. But there is explicit testimony that after they got facts from law on partway through the job telling them don't do extra work, that they called down the job site. Lawman's on-site monitor was out there, they were still loading trucks, so they called New Jersey to the home office and they said, well, it's business as usual on the job site, we don't understand what this fax means, but they just kept working anyway.
No, but even the Court of Appeals didn't keep laughing yet.
No, they didn't, although that was because they paid the microphone.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Maybe, or they just didn't find any liability in law.
Well, I don't believe there is, but that's my opinion. In conclusion, Your Honor, I want to mention before I sit down, we put two color photographs in our brief on the hope that a picture is worth a thousand words. This was a huge job. It was about $93 million. The $165,000 environmental remediation portion of the job, as you can see from the photograph, is a very, very minor part. The Convention Center staff, the record shows, was very small. It had a volunteer board created pursuant to statute, and it ought not to be even subconscious. thought of as an entity which should have been out there policing every square inch of this huge job site and telling the contractor, hey, wait, you've got to stop, you've gone too far.
There isn't any, Mr. Fry, there isn't any question that this additional material had to be removed from the site. Is that correct?
No,
there's no dispute
correct.
About that.
There is a dispute about that.
Is there? I thought there was not. Okay.
No, there's very definitely a dispute about that, Your Honor. And that's the reason why the first two-minute telephone call between Mr. Fitton from Foster Wheeler and Clarissa Way at the convention center was so important, because she, in that phone call late one afternoon when they said, we think we found more hazardous materials, said, we'll take our, you take your direction to the law. And what she meant was, if she's testified, we don't know whether the stuff is really all contaminated or not.
Right.
The nature of these brownfield projects is, until you open it up and do chemical testing, you can't tell what you're into. And that's why there was a great uncertainty about how much of this was really.
So the tagging of the material that was in the trucks being moved away, that tagging wasn't significant as to what was in the material, is that right? I mean, Lawhon was responsible to do that, weren't they?
Lawhon was responsible for doing that, but what the exact makeup of each of those trucks was and how much of it was definitely contaminated.
Was there any way to test it to determine if there were contaminants?
And yes.
Before it was taken out of the soil, could they keep testing? And
well, they could have done more borings around the box. They did three or four test borings, as I recall, before this all started, when they first discovered a piece of the box sticking out of the ground. And they tried to find out the size of the box and how deep the tar material was. But what they missed was the fact that it migrated so far out of the box in an underground migration up there was stuck.
But assuming that all, I think the Chief Justice's questions like mine, assuming that that there's no debate that the stuff that was taken out was indeed contaminated, you know, and that I think that I'm interested in, wasn't that inevitable that the project really, as these things go, you can't leave it on site. It has to go.
That's not true.
No.
We had two alternatives, and it's in the record that one of the alternatives was encapsulation is in place. You open it up, you put bisqueen over it, put clay on top of it so that it's impermeable to water, and you leave it there. This is out in a parking lot, well away from the building. There's no chance of fumes or any other toxicity to human beings. And in fact, they did leave some in the ground. After Foster Wheeler finally stopped, there were still these rivulets of coal tar out in the underground area. They just simply went in with a different contractor and walled it off, put clay, and sealed it as best they could against the elements left.
That's an acceptable remediation.
It is.
So the convention center's ultimate position is that we've been required to pay for the removal of material that may not have had to been removed by someone.
Exactly. We would have, if somebody had come into the board at the outset and said, this is going to cost your board $1 million, I believe the board would never approve it. The estimate was it's going to cost $175,000. Well, in that case, since we're on site, the chairman may have been like, let's go in and take this extra step and try and be good citizens.
So that we understand the facts, if I read so much correctly, you were under no finding or order from any environmental agency at all with respect to this. So you could have, once you discovered, are you required to report it?
I believe we were. We did certainly report it, and there was EPA kind of back in approval of our plan to remediate it, but they never put us under an order, you will take it out or you will.
So you even had the option to just take the parking lot and do nothing?
I don't know about totally doing nothing, but certainly we could have put the clay layer down, which would have probably been far less expensive than anything we ended up having to do.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. My list shows Mr. Donaldson next, right?
Okay.
Mr. Donaldson.
May I ask the first question? Your I guess the most troubling thing is that in this contract and in the argument that you make is that the contract did include the 140 cubic yard estimate. Isn't the purpose of including that estimate to define the scope of the work?
I believe it is, but I also believe that the only definition drawn by them in the contract scope of work is the one that says all of that would be removed, plus all contaminated material contained in the area. That's why Wacom was on site as their representative every day to dig. They dig, Wacom said, fine, dig some more, whatever. That's why they set it up that way to begin with. And I think for scope of work to include anything, I think for them to get a written change order would have been a situation where had they on another part of the job site or very nearby discovered a stacked box, they would have waited for a written change order.
I understand your argument on that. I'm wondering though, why then did your client, EnviroResponse, react when they apparently used the words they were aware, became aware first day, I guess, that there was a changed condition. And it struck me that just having come to that conclusion, that even your client seemed to believe that was something significant enough that ought to rise to the level of scope of the work.
Well, I'm afraid it's the same way. I think what happened was our people understood during the pre-bid negotiations and all that this is what was going to be there. That's why they wanted the unit price in there. The other side did, and our people wouldn't go along with it. And it would be automatic if you got into work beyond the 140 cubic yard, automatically go to unit price. And I think that's why when our people, it was the very first day, they discovered that my guys, there's material outside the box, and they not only contacted the on-site monitor, saw it obviously, what they call Ms. Sueda over the authority, and she said, don't talk to me, deal with Wacom. And then the next day they were reprimanded by Wacom, saying, don't you dare go back to the authority, you deal only with us. They felt they'd done everything they could to take care of the situation, and they felt that looking at that asterisk footnote on the unit price agreement, that's clearly what it provided for.
Well, that's kind of hard to say. You know, there is that argument that it, you know, on the same page it says it's got to be authorized.
Well, but I think, Your Honor, if you go to that page, and you know, I have the whole thing is set forth on page 16 of our brief, I think the trial court did not deal with all the provisions there, but I think the Court of Appeals very clearly did. And I think the second paragraph we talked about may be used for an authorized increase or decrease in the scope. Is an entirely different situation than when they come down with an asterisk and deal and say it will be used for just the quantity, and that the measure of that would be that the contractor will make measurements observed by a representative and consultant. And that was very simply done here by the representative and consultant signing each of the hazardous waste manifests for the 142 trucks, thereby verifying that was hazardous waste being shipped out that they do every day.
Yeah. We'll address then, if you will, that your client continued to remove in the face of this fact that said stop.
Yes, ma'am. I think there may be a fact dispute there. They did not continue to excavate, but they continued to clean up the piles that were on the side and take that to the dump. That had to be done. And again, Wacom, even though they send out this memo, they're signing each one of the waste manifests. And our people continue to be under the obligation of the contract. Time is of the essence, $250 liquidated damages, and a liability for all of their losses that the authority might suffer while walking off the job site.
So Wacom is your reason for not speaking to the owner?
Yes,
about
ma'am. Most definitely. Mm-hmm. We were reprimanded by them not to do that. We were told by the authority, you deal with Wacom, not with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really think the Court of Appeals had it wrong, too. It's Lawthorne you think is responsible to you, not the authority.
No, Your Honor, I don't think the Court of Appeals had it wrong. I think they had 100% right. And I think they looked at this contract as if these parties really drew this contract. This is what they intended by this contract. I think also, though, I think we're wrong about Wacom. I can understand how once they say the authority's liable, we're going to let Wacom go. The proposition that puts us in, this court affirmed, we go back and try damages against the authority. And then if for some reason we can't can't collect against the authority, we've got nobody to collect from.
Yeah, but the major portion of your argument is it was Lawthorne, if anybody, who had the authority to say yes or no, go forward. That provision of the contract, when I looked at the contract, it seems to me that the authority in the bids and the specifications and the contract gave sole authority to Lawthorne to interpret the terms of the contract.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that would be final. Their interpretation would be final.
Right. Right. And if that's the case, you say they told you to go on, then why do you have any claim against the authority at all?
Well, because the facts are in dispute. Our people are saying they told us that they have authority to tell us to do additional. They told us we would be paid. They told us we were under the unit price provision, and Ms. Sawaya is telling the board we're into an overage situation that we paid under the unit price agreement, and you know, that's why we find ourselves in a situation where we're saying it's the authority who ultimately is liable here. And
if that's the ultimate argument, why would you ever put into a contract, and my recollection is it's at least three places I remember reading it, that any change had to be by written order?
I think, Your Honor, because this was a general contract that the authority, as Mr. Price said, used on, I don't know how many, 10 or 15 or 20 contracts like this. When it came to this one, they knew they were dealing with a different situation. They were being advised by law. This is touchy. We don't know what's there. They have all the boilerplate change order language in the contract, but they did not square up to the unit price provision. If they really wanted to have a change order, that asterisk footnote should have said, if it's going to be over 140 cubic yards or under, we need a written change order. They could have provided for that.
Have you ever drawn a contract for an owner that you didn't put this change order provision in there to be in writing? Because otherwise, an owner has no control.
Well, I have not drawn contracts on the litigation order through, but I think I think it's unfair for them now to come back and point to general change order language we gave the court authority in here on one of our pages that obviously the specific unit price provision language governs over the more general language with respect to the change orders. And I think it's absolutely clear what the parties provide for it. That was the language that they submitted to in their bid proposal. This is the language that everybody agreed to.
Counsel, I'd like to back you up to where your case appears to me to be the strongest, get you to focus on that. And that is your case against Lawthorne. And you sued them on a couple of different theories. One, negligent preparation of bid specifications. Judge Thompson wipes that aside rather easily. But then also for, and you characterize what your cause of action was for their direction to remove the additional material and to not worry about the other commandments of the contract. And what was your legal theory presented?
Whatever theory is, Your Honor,
what did you plead? Because you're out on pleadings here.
Well, I think, Your Honor, obviously, if we're dealing with notice pleadings here, what we intended to do was to plead what we knew at the time, and all we were suggesting was that they were negligent in both their original specifications and there how far they went in defining how much waste was there and where it was located. And then secondarily, once they got into supervising and overseeing the contract, if they are the ultimate interpreter of the contract documents and the provisions of those documents, and that interpretation is final, and they represent us, we're under the unit price provision, the truckloads will set the quantity, whatever the quantity is, times 265 cubic yards, that's what we're doing it under. Then I think that clearly represents a misrepresentation by them, negligently.
Okay. And was there a dispute that should have survived summary in this area?
Well, I think absolutely there was.
And what was that dispute? What was the difference in what was put in an affidavit form?
With respect to the second point,
yes.
I believe that what they were in affidavit form, we had the affidavit of Mr. Fenton from our organization and Mr. Mark Frank from our organization. which they indicated that the consultant, they talked to the consultant said, we're into an overage situation, change orders not required. I realize there's a dispute about Mr. Montferri never being available for deposition. They knew where he was and didn't get him. There's also a dispute about Mike Finn's testimony, because he testified by deposition and later comes in with an affidavit, which we used. And as I explained on brief, there was a clear situation there where he was not directly contradicting himself. The deposition testimony talked only really about the change order situation. It did not address the affidavit situation that's been talked about. We will get paid. We have authority to tell you to do the additional. And that's in dispute, because he says that's what happened, and they say, no, that's not what happened.
How much material did you ultimately haul away?
It was approximately 3,500 cubic yards. And it's an interesting note that after the claim was made at the end, Lawhon did, by its own calculations, come up with figures which range from 60,000 to 517,000, based upon which figures you use of the material that actually removed. Lawhon, I would like to say, with respect to this encapsulating this material, Lawhon was the one who suggested taking it out and hauling it away. If it's only 140 cubic yards, it seems to me it was easier to quote it from the encapsulation process from the beginning.
Did your firm have the capacity and capability to do that, provide that service as well?
I don't know the engineer. I'm assuming that, because they are a total environmental.
So if they had been directed to, we've got a big area, this is a different deal, let's find a cheaper, easier way. As far as you know, your client could have.
That is correct. And I also would say that, had they decided to do that, it would have been in the bid to begin with, and that's what we would have been bidding on. But subsequently, once the first day we called, they could have pulled back and said, ooh, wait a minute, maybe we ought to encapsulate this. They could have at any point over the 38 days that we were on the site doing the work. Nobody ever did that. It's never suggested by anybody.
The language you most rely on is a unit price language.
Correct, John.
If that's the case, what would it mean when it says a unit price may be used to calculate the cost, in effect, for an authorized increase? What would authorized increase mean?
John, I think an authorized increase, back to the definition of provisions of the contract, would be by a written change order or some type of written document.
Okay, I agree. We didn't have that, did we?
That's correct, we did not.
So, do you ever get to the unit price computation if there was not an authorized increase?
Yes, Your Honor, you do. Because that second paragraph that you just quoted to, I think page 60 of my brief, that situation talks about simply a situation where the parties, they may agree to adjust the contract sum up or down, should there be an authorized increase or decrease in the scope of the work.
But is the condition preceding that you have to have an authorized increase?
Well, Your Honor, that's right, but you're talking about a situation here on the scope of the work. If the scope of the work here was to remove 140 cubic yards of the box and all contaminated areas around it, Long on top telling us to dig further, take it. And the evidence is, Wong's own man out there, Mr. Braun, said that every time he dug 10 feet, it was just as bad, we had to dig 10 feet more. So that all comes within the definition of all contaminated area around it. So that's my position, that you don't reach into a change in the scope of work and offer this increase or decrease. You would only need to get to that if you're going to work on this box, and then this link goes away, but we've got another box just like this over on the other side. Then I think everybody says, now we're in this type of provision where we might use those prices or we might not. I think in our situation, they want to make it very clear that it will be used in the ask to adjust the quantity, and they provide the mechanism of how that will be measured very clearly.
You would agree, would you not, that in a contract for a work like this that you have to have a unit price?
I would say I don't think you need to. I think that it hadn't been a request, as was suggested, that we just encapsulate the 140 cubic yards. Our people might well be able to put in a bid for $100,000 to do whatever they're saying could have been done, flat price, because they would know properly what they're dealing with. Now, had they gotten into something beyond that, where once they got there, then I could get into general contract provisions and really extremely changed circumstances. You can get into a change order.
there's a drastic change in the from the estimate. You know, in this case, it appeared that it was a drastic difference from the estimate from the get-go when they first excavated. I mean, is there some continuum here that, you know, a slight change would not trigger the need for authorization under the contract, but a drastic change would? And I say this because, interestingly, that footnoted asterisk definition that said will be calculated, and at the last of that speaks to, you know, that we paid for no more, you know, 1 cubic yard, what's that language at the bottom that says we paid for no, they were down to whether it was a whole cubic yard or not.
Adjustments will not be made for less than 1 cubic yard.
Yeah.
The closest cubic yard.
You know, that seems like that was contemplated for, really, perhaps that suggests it was contemplating minor variations from the estimate of 140 cubic yards.
Well, Your Honor, all I can say to that is that if that's the reading this court would choose to put on it, then I think we're into, at worst, an ambiguity situation that we don't give up on summary judgment. We go back and try the whole thing, which I'm not suggesting should happen.
Okay.
But that reading, that's where we ought to be. And I'll stop on the surface at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I'll give you a little time. Mr. Byers.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address the claims against Lawhonna. It's important to remember that it's a negligent misrepresentation claim and only a negligent misrepresentation claim. This court has adopted the restatement of torts second, which says in order for a plaintiff to prevail, the defendant has to provide false information in a negligent manner that the defendant justifiably relies upon and is damaged. Now, in this case, there is no evidence that Lawhonna told Foster Wheeler, keep on digging, you don't need a change order, you'll be paid. There's no evidence of that.
There's none?
There is none. There is only evidence that the on-site monitor allegedly said that.
Well, now, wait a minute. This is summary. If there's evidence that your client allegedly said that, then it isn't the plaintiff contractor entitled to get past summary on that issue, on that claim. That's what I've been focusing.
And let me focus you, Your Honor. The reason why the answer is no. The supplemental conditions, which were placed in the contract at Lawhonna's request, expressly and severely limit the authority of the on-site monitor. This is page 20 of my brief. And they state, quote, on-site monitor has no authority to permit or require any deviation from the contract document for substitution of materials. The on-site monitor had no authority. Let's even assume he did say, you don't need a change order. He had no authority. If the contract required a change order, he could not modify that
under the contract. But what's the nature of the lawsuit brought against your client? What did you just describe?
It's a negligent misrepresentation claim, Your Honor, but there has to be justifiable reliance, as the court has ruled in Delman.
So if the contract clearly says your client doesn't have authority to do it, and your client is out there saying, dig, and don't you dare call it Claire Sawyer again, that isn't sufficient to get beyond summary
No, Your Honor, it isn't, because there has to be justifiable reliance. In the city of Delman versus Cleveland Heights, the city of Cleveland Heights had a statute that required inspections.
Okay, but the facts here are, I believe, that they called Blair, she said, deal with law.
That was not with respect to change orders, Your Honor, and this is briefed in my brief. When they first started digging, and they're digging down 10 feet, they found out that maybe the topsoil on top was contaminated. They called Claire Savoy and said, what do we do about this 10 feet? We think it may be contaminated. According to the specs, it's supposed to be set aside and then used as backfill. And Claire Savoy naturally said in a 2-minute phone conversation, and this is part of the record, with respect to the topsoil, take your direction from Lawhonna. That cannot be expanded to take your direction from Lawhonna on everything. We'll step back. We'll let Lawhonna run the show. We don't care about the contract. That is the only place in the record where there's any claim.
Well, let me read you what Judge Thompson said, because there's really only two sentences that go to this issue. He said, plaintiff was not entitled to rely on oral representations of any employee to the defendant law, that a written request for authorization to proceed was not needed. Furthermore, it has not been proven that any employee of Dave Laughlin made such representation. Well, that statement really isn't the correct analysis of whether or not you get to summary. So that sentence is probably wrong.
I agree with you with respect to the second sentence, Your Honor.
The first sentence is really what you're hanging your hat on here.
Absolutely. I'm hanging my hat on the on-site monitor. You know, we have a situation where Laughlin was paid about $12,000 for his services. If environmental consultants are going to be subject to multi-million dollar suits based upon hazardous waste that nobody can tell about until they get in, based upon purported oral representation by their on-site monitor who has no authority expressly to make such representation, they're not going to need consultants.
Well, let's back up then. So your environmental consultants out there, the contractors digging, so instead of taking 140 cubic yards away, your guy's there while he takes away how much?
About 3,000.
Instead of 140.
Right, but the rest.
And it never occurred to your guy to say to anybody, what are we doing here?
Well, the record is clear that he did.
Is it your client's view that this contractor is a volunteer and he's doing this out of
the consultant
civic mindedness?
The on-site monitor, and this is proof in the record, did say, what are we doing here? Don't you need a change order? Don't you need a change order? And that's why on October 27th, Mike Pitt and Foster Wheeler on a Sunday faxed a letter to Laughlin saying, gee, you know, we've removed $371,000 above and beyond the basic bid. You know, maybe we ought to talk about it. And what did Laughlin do? The next morning at 8:30, a fax went out saying, stop. Don't take out any more. Did they stop? No. They took out an extra $571,000 from the topsoil. Now, you can call it excavating, but the trucks took off with it.
But isn't that what a trial would be about rather than summary?
I don't think in that case, Your Honor. You know, it's my position that you have to have justifiable reliance. And if you've got a contract that says you can't rely on this on-site monitor, he is there only to observe the law and to ensure technical compliance with the contract, you can't rely upon him saying other things.
Well, who were they relying on when they continued to take all this material out of the site?
I don't think they knew what they were doing. They had never read the contract. That was the point that's made by Mr. Fry in his brief. Nobody from Foster Wheeler read the contract.
You mean those people were so ignorant that they would continue taking this material off the site?
This
for no good reason? They mean that these people... Please.
I'm sorry, John. I apologize.
You try to overtalk Judge Pfeiffer, and the little as I have to say, I'm fighting to get it in. Do you mean to say that these people who are professionals would go ahead and remove all this topsoil and all this contaminated thing without making sure they have authority? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that's what they did, Your Honor. In fact, when they were told to stop, they removed $500,000 worth more. That's a fact. It's not disputed. It is undisputed.
Well, in addition to that, there was an admission they never read the contract.
Every single person...
The testimony that I read...
...both admitted that they didn't read it. Every single one of them.
You've used your time, Mr. Byers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Fry, you look like you want to have rebuttal, and Mr. Donaldson will also. Fry, do you want to go first?
Thank you. I wanted to respond briefly to Justice Weiss's question about discussions in the negative misrepresentation. That the supplement at pages 289 and 283, there's direct testimony from Mr. Pitt that he had no discussions about change orders with either Dr. Raines or Mr. Ball. I believe the case comes back on their side that they relied only on the on-site monitor, and that, of course, is disputed, but I take your point that summary judgment disputes against your jury. But I raise this because for an owner, being able to get cost-effective consultants to do these brownfield remediation projects is a significant matter, not just
general conditions, the subsurface conditions clause, which is a very standard construction contract clause that says if you find something that's materially different from what's been expected, give us written notice. Of course, we didn't have that in here too either. Finally, I want to point out that there are not just the contract attachment A, but there is page S37 of the record, Article 7B of the general conditions, which is also a unit price clause, which is not a verbatim copy of contract attachment A, but deals in general terms as a mirror image of contract attachment A. And they both use the words may and follow in a way which shows that my client was entitled to be an authorization before this contract was exploded in this way. And Justice Sweeney's surprise at the way it happened, I think, can only be explained by the fact that this was a company which was new in Ohio. They had to hire two new people. One was actually a salesman who was put on this job. The other man, Mr. Bigelow, was brought to Michigan to supervise this job. They didn't have the contract. The home office was in New Jersey. That's where the bidding had been done. And they didn't brief these guys or send them contract. So we had that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. And Mr. Donaldson.
Thanks, Your Honor. Just two brief points with respect to the comments that the counsel's law on. One is that we noted in our reply brief, they seem to be relying very heavily on the language that says that the on-site monitor cannot deviate. But we noted that if you look at the supplemental conditions in the contract, S68 and S69, they were, it implies that they were to assist in understanding the interpretation of contract documents, determine if the work was proceeding pursuant to contract documents, report to the consultant, the on-site monitor would report to the consultant when the work is not being performed in performance, and fourth, advise the consultant when there was required a special approval. Those four things were the duties of the on-site monitor. And they may come in here, the courts would forward to this court and say, well, you're just sitting out there observing. But he signed every single one of those 142 waste manifests. Even after the notice came in to leave the job site, he continued to sign to remove the material still left there. The second point is, really ties into the first one, and that is, the reason they kept moving the material was because, again, even though they had the letter they had, they continued to sign it and say, give permission for it to go to the dump. And I don't think, as a matter of equity, that needs to fall on a fire response. All that material was removed. There's no question it was removed. There may be back questions about how much it was contaminated or the degree of contamination. It goes off with the damage issues, not to the questions of liability.
Thank you, Mr. Donaldson. The case is submitted. You'll be advised for our opinion.